First Lady Mamie Eisenhower was born in 1896 in a little house in Boone, Iowa. Her family didn't live there long, but since 1980, the little yellow house has been a museum. But that may be changing. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, the future of the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower Birthplace. I'll talk with Mara McKay, Executive Director of the Museum, and Docent Kathy Sterling. I'll also talk with Michael Moraine of the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs about historic sites around the state. Then later, a conversation with Cedar Falls artist Gary Kelly. He illustrated the new book, Next Year, Hope in the Dust. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, a conversation with Cedar Falls artist Gary Kelly. We'll talk about his latest picture book project and also how he's illustrating a Halloween concert with the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony. But first, news broke last week that the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower Birthplace Museum in Boone, Iowa, is having trouble keeping the doors open. The Little Yellow House in Boone has been a museum since 1980, but attendance has been declining and fundraising efforts have fallen short. With me to talk about the museum and the future of the museum is Mara McKay. She is Executive Director of the museum. Hello, Mara.
Hello. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And also, Docent Kathy Sterling is here. Hello, Kathy.
Hello.
Thank you for being here. And Mara, first of all, let's talk about what is going on with the museum. Again, it's been open since 1980. What's been going on in recent years?
Well, we have had a dedicated volunteer group that has been giving tours, and the site is a beautiful, lovely era gone by, recollections of the Victorian days. And we have had a lot of enthusiasm in our local community to keep this museum vibrant and going, but we struggle to reach the numbers that can sustain our facility as it has been for many years a museum. So right now, the board has decided to close the facility and consider all of the options and evaluate what we could do moving forward.
And you have tried some fundraising efforts in recent months, and people have been supportive, but not as supportive as you needed.
That's correct. And in 2006, this facility became part of the Boone County Historical Society, which operates four museums within Boone History Museums around the county. And in that portfolio, we really have had a challenge of trying to evaluate how to tell those stories, how to maintain the facilities, and what's the best way to engage the people around history.
So you're going to be closing the museum, and we'll talk more about the possibilities for the future, but you're not certain of what's going to happen yet, right?
No, we're looking at several different ideas that have been presented. And one of those ideas is that Mamie's could join the other American icons like Frank Sinatra, Dick Clark, John Steinbeck in having a vacation rental that would still be able to tell some of the history. But we haven't solidified around any one plan or idea yet. The truth is you need a sustainable plan moving forward to have this into perpetuity, into the long term. But nostalgia is a very powerful force. So we're struggling a bit to move ahead and know exactly how we want to manage going forward.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the museum. Now, first of all, when will it be closing as the timeline moves forward?
Every year we close on October 31st. And ironically, Mamie was the first lady who was the first lady to celebrate Halloween in the White House. So every year we close the facility. It's no different this year, but we wanted to give people the opportunity to see this museum in the idea that it may be end up changing. It may change function.
Right. So you have a few more days on the weekend if you'd like to go to the museum. Let's talk a little bit about Mamie Eisenhower. And Kathy, I would love for you to jump in here as well as you show people around the house. I know you tell a lot of people about Mamie Eisenhower. She was born in this house, but didn't live here for very long, right?
That's correct. And in fact, the house actually was located across the street. It had been used as three apartments, and then it was used as a Sunday school, and then the Baptist church didn't need it anymore, and they were going to actually destroy the house. But she lived actually in the house for 9 months.
So only 9 months, and then her family moved on to Cedar Rapids, right?
Correct, and then from there to Denver.
So how did this house come into the ownership of the Boone Historical Society? When did that happen? I mean, after they moved out, obviously it was many years before the world knew who Mamie Eisenhower was.
That is correct. In 1970, Mamie received an award from the governor, the Goldfinch Award. And so while Mamie did come back to Boone often to visit her Uncle Joel, from the Carlson side of the family, she had frequented Boone often in terms of having lunch with people and shopping and visiting with her favorite uncle. However, the Goldfinch Award brought her back into the spotlight. And at the same time, in the 70s, there was a resurgence across America to redo old homes, to have wallpapers and carpets and reproduction things. So that was something that was common across America, not just with Mamie's house. And so the people that knew Mamie, older people, came together and had this thought of, rather than having this house destroyed, what could we do? And that began the project of Mamie. That coming together was in 1975, and then the house was ready in 1980 and was dedicated then.
So when people visit the museum, what do they see?
Well, we always start with the story of Mamie's family, the Swedish side and the English side, and where her home was located. They see a few things of Mamie's. They definitely see the bed that she was born in, but they mostly see and learn about what a Victorian home looked like.
Are there artifacts in the home that belong to Mamie Eisenhower?
Well, there are a set of chairs that she personally gave to us, and then there is a clock that she gave to us. The rest of the things actually came from the Carlson family, as well as items that have been donated that would have been period to that Victorian time.
I think Mamie Eisenhower is a name that a lot of people know. And of course, those of us who live in Iowa, a lot of us at least know that she was born in Iowa. But let's talk about her. She was a very fashionable lady. She got married quite young at the age of 19, although that was a very common thing at the time. What was she like?
Well, she was an intriguing person who really had a charm about her. She spoke to the common person, and she cared about people. She wanted to be everyone's friend, and she had a very low-key role, wanted to support her husband, but she also took charge of the White House, and she was known as the five-star general of Pennsylvania Avenue, and she took care of the everyday happenings and the workings. She changed the White House. She was very influential in decorating. She actually was disappointed at her budget many times because she wanted to make it beautiful, the entire home. She hosted many occasions and events for people to come in. She was a polished socialite from her early years with the Dowd family. And she was a soft-spoken but charming and much-loved figure.
And, of course, almost always, first ladies are noticed for their fashion because, of course, they go to certain events where they have to wear ball gowns and things like that. We've had some very fashionable first ladies through time, and that influences often what other people wear. Mamie Eisenhower, with her fashion, she was extremely influential, wasn't she?
Absolutely. She coined the Mamie pink color of the 50s. She transformed millions of kitchens into having pink sinks and pink appliances. And she was influential for that time and that era. But then, you know, perhaps to some, maybe overshadowed by Jacqueline Kennedy a bit. She had signature bangs that she changed people's appearance. Just all kinds of young ladies were turning themselves into bangs, and she started those trends. So she is really a force, and a force of good and positive energy that people can love and remember. And it's fun that she has those connections to Iowa.
And her signature shade of pink, that was set out very early in her time as First Lady. I've seen her inauguration gown, and it was that shade of pink. So that started right away when her husband took office.
Absolutely. It's one of the most visited displays in the Smithsonian, the White House dresses. And hers is a dynamic, beautiful piece that people really enjoy to this day. So she is a colorful, fascinating woman who spoke highly of her duties and was proud to be the First Lady. And she took great pride in everything that she did there to carry the spirit of America.
Now, you mentioned that she was a gracious hostess. Mm-hmm. There were also concerns or rumors, perhaps, because she seemed to have a problem with balance. And some people thought maybe that indicated a drinking problem, but that's not what historians have said.
No, she actually had Meniere's disease. And so she did have a balance issue. And she struggled from a very young age with some of those health issues related to that.
So what do you think her legacy is? Of course, we know a lot about her husband's legacy with the interstate highways in particular. What do you think the legacy of Mamie Eisenhower is?
Well, I think that she really brings around that idea of supporting the country. At a time that we were struggling, her husband was gone for 3 years. She traveled. She moved 27 times, it was reported. And I believe that she shows an era of stability for the country, but it's because she stood fast behind her person, her soldier, and her leader. And I think that that's her legacy, to be that person at home, that she would be behind Ike at all times. And I think that that is something that we as a nation look at now differently, of course, because we are a two-working family in a lot of senses, but she constantly had that legacy of being Ike's strength behind the force of Dwight Eisenhower.
Well, we're going to take a short break here. We'll be back in just a moment. Right now, we're talking about the future of the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower Birthplace Museum in Boone, Iowa. It's been a museum since 1980, a little yellow house. The interior is done up in the Victorian era. And of course, we're talking about former First Lady Mamie Eisenhower, born in Iowa. With me right now, Mara McKay, Executive Director of the Museum, and Docent Kathy Sterling. In a minute, we're also going to talk about some other small historic sites around the state. And if you have a favorite historic site maybe in your community or one that you love to visit, we'd love to hear about it from you. You can give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll talk with Cedar Falls artist Gary Kelly. He's just published his latest picture book project. It's called Next Year, Hope in the Dust by Ruth Vanderzee. He illustrated the book. We'll also talk about how he's illustrating a Halloween concert with the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony. Right now, we're talking about the future of the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower Birthplace Museum in Boone. News broke last week that the museum, that's been open since 1980, will be closing its doors on October 31st. The future of the museum is unclear at the moment. With me right now, Mara McKay, Executive Director of the Museum, and docent Kathy Sterling coming up in just a few minutes. We'll talk about some other small historic sites around the state. And of course, we'd love to hear about your favorite. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And I want to ask the two of you. Now, of course, there was a time when the First Lady was also considered to be kind of a role model for homemakers and hostesses around the country. Mamie Eisenhower was not much of a homemaker in the sense that cooking was not her thing, I've read. Tell me more about that.
No, actually, it was the president that did the most of the cooking once he was home from war. Mamie grew up with an affluent family, and so there was always someone to cook and do the housekeeping growing up. And then she, her income was sustained by her father sending money once she was home. She had gone to finish what they called finishing school back then, and she knew the etiquettes of entertaining, but she just didn't know cooking. She did know how to make mayonnaise, which was very, very important. And she knew how to.
Why was mayonnaise so important?
Well, we didn't have jar mayonnaise when she was growing up. Mayonnaise was always made by hand at the time that it was served at the dinner table. And mayonnaise was just one of those things that was almost always put on the table.
All right. So she was good at mayonnaise. Did she have any other specialties?
Yes, she was wonderful at making fudge as well.
All right. So stirring was really her
absolutely
best kitchen skill.
Absolutely.
That's great.
Yes.
So when we look to the future now, I mean, as the museum is closing, how do you guys feel about the museum closing? I know you've both worked really hard to keep it open. Kathy, what do you feel we're losing?
In my personal opinion and professional opinion, looking at it from a history perspective, I think that the contents inside the home can be recreated on one of the floors in the historical society, and it would be open to everyone, and they could see it, and there would be docents there as well. So I don't think that we're losing that. What I think that is truly being felt, Mamie was known for shopping in Boone when she came. She was known for having lunch with the average person. She didn't put herself up on a pedestal. She was just Mamie. And so I think that aspect is being mourned in our town. And so the question is, and I don't have the answer for that. I do think that the home can be kept once the maintenance on it can be put. I think that there can be a Victorian gazebo put on our land where we can have weddings. There's no place in Boone that you can have that kind of an outdoor formal. So I think we would greatly gain that and still have the sweetness of the Victorian era, which I think lots of people miss and would like to step back in time. So from that aspect, I think that it can be balanced, but that's my opinion.
Mara, what do you feel?
Well, I agree with those sentiments, and I really believe that nostalgia, it's powerful for people. And I believe that a lot of our community members have, it's something that gives you a freedom to remember. It's almost a drug. It's almost going back in time. And it's definitely the power of history, because when you can go back to a different time and you can feel that, what you felt when you were putting together this museum, when you knew that you were going to have Mamie come into the community and be proud and see this, that was a great feeling for this area. And I think that that's the part that people tend to struggle with, making this transition, making an adjustment. But certainly we think that we can bring around a new future for the Mamie Eisenhower and the complete Boone's First family history, in that we want to tell the story for years to come. It's just, how do we have that story told? I mean, having that dialogue is really important with our community. So I hope that through this we can gain a sense of coming together, of uniting around the Eisenhower history. And I think that's what Mamie and Ike would want. I think that her spirit with the common people, that she knew, she was very practical. She was very nuts and bolts. When it came right down to it, she was a resourceful person, and I think that's what it's going to take to continue to bring her legend into the future.
And you mentioned the possibility of having sort of a vacation rental or Airbnb type opportunity with this home as a way of maintaining the upkeep. That's one of the plans you're considering. Are there other plans in the mix?
You know, that's one of the ideas. Another idea to carry through the history is to actually have a video that would be interactive that we could put on YouTube or share on other platforms that younger people would be able to understand that time frame. They could walk into the home and see how the Iceman would have left the ice or see how the coal would have been put into the stove. And there are many ways that we can actually share this history and try to be as dynamic as possible. Of course, we want to save the home and make it vibrant again, but how we go about doing that to preserve it, to conserve those artifacts that are inside, it's going to be an effort, and everybody will need to come together around this idea of being open to new thoughts and ways of going about that.
When do you think you'll make a decision?
We've decided to take up to 2 years to really look at all of the different ways and opportunities that exist and the potential for the site to be something for many years to come that could be there for the public. And if not, if the support's not there, we would have to then look at other things, like I mentioned, avenues through video or new technology. But I think the conversation is one that you don't want to have rushed, and it's one that you want to engage as many people as possible. And that's not always easy, because around something like this, emotions do tend to run high. But we believe that there are people around that can help us in the historical community. This is, I believe, why the humanities are so important. And I think that our community all across America, people need to look at how vital the humanities are. And when we're talking about the National Endowment of the Humanities being proposed as being eliminated, those are the kind of supports that American heritage places like Mamie's need to have in place.
Well, Mara McKay, thank you so much for talking with me.
Mm-hmm.
Mara McKay, thank Executive you. Director of the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower Birthplace Museum in Boone, Iowa. Kathy Sterling, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Kathy Sterling, one of the docents at the museum. The museum will be closing its doors on October 31st, as it does every year. The future of the museum is uncertain at this moment. I want to bring Michael Moraine into the conversation now. He is communications manager for the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs. And while the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs is not responsible for the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower Museum in Boone, they are responsible for a number of other small historical sites around the state. Hello, Michael.
Hello. Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And we've been talking about how attendance at this particular museum has fallen off in recent years. Do you feel like that's part of a larger trend, or is this an individual case?
It can be. It sounds like Mara and Kathy and Team Mamie are doing all the right things. What's so important, I learned some just from their segment, but what's so important about any of these historic sites is to have a story, to really boil down the story and be able to connect that story to modern-day visitors who don't remember when President and Mrs. Eisenhower were in that White House. So, I mean, just the idea that Mamie made mayonnaise, that was news to me. I would love to have them. I don't know if they could make batches of Mamie's mayonnaise and sell it as a fundraiser, but some way to connect that history and make Mamie Eisenhower a real person for people who don't remember seeing her at the inauguration ball on TV or who don't remember that era. So the trick is to take a historic place and keep it from becoming just a time capsule that's sort of interesting on its own, but really connecting that story to modern-day visitors, especially younger generations who don't remember all of the details.
Right. I would be more inclined to buy Mamie's fudge than mayonnaise, but that's just a small focus group note for you. we asked people to call in and share some of their favorite museums around the state. Jim is on the line in Spencer. Hi, Jim.
Hi, it's me, naturally. No, I had to bring up the Abby Gardner Museum in Arnold's Park, Iowa. It's just, very low-key and gritty kind of historic location that, you know, you can really feel the time. You know, it hasn't been polished in any way, I don't think, and it's a simple place, but it really lends itself, you know, clearly to its own history, and it's a very important, you know, site. And I think in its own defense, it like most of these places, they really need funding from the state. It's just critical.
Well, Jim, thank you for mentioning that museum. And that is actually part of the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, the Abby Gardner Sharp Cabin in Arnold's Park. And the cabin, I guess, Michael, you can tell me more about it. But, of course, this is the site of the Spirit Lake Massacre.
That's right. And I'm glad he brought it up. It's one of the 8 sites that the State Historical Society manages and oversees across the state. And the Abby Gardner Sharp Cabin is an interesting, it has a great story because it was one of Iowa's first tourist attractions. So it was the grisly site of the Spirit Lake Massacre. But Abby Gardner Sharp, it was her family who was killed there. And she survived and was kidnapped and then returned into freedom. And she returned later as an adult and turned it into one of Iowa's first tourist attractions. So it's a strange story. But the Abby Gardner Sharp Cabin, one thing that's cool about it is, as the caller said, it is sort of left as is. You can see the cabin and you can imagine sort of the creepy story of what it was like and how scary that must have been. But it's tucked in a little corner, sort of just a stone's throw from the lake and from Arnold's Park Amusement Park and all of that. So it has the benefit of crowds, summer crowds. So it has that going for it. But it's one of those great stories where the story is so much better if you're there in the place and you can see it and you can really get up close to the history and it comes alive.
Well, and let's talk about some of the other historic sites that are part of the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, because I think that there is a really wide variety that also gives us some insight into how these sites can function. I mean, one of them is the American Gothic House in Eldon, which is not a museum itself. But tell me more about how the Department of Cultural Affairs has managed that site.
Right. The American Gothic House, there's really not much story there. Grant Wood was passing by one day, and he saw it, and he liked the house, and then sketched it, and then it became the famous backdrop in one of the world's most famous paintings. So not much happened there in terms of history, but now, 80 or 90 years later, 16,000 or 17,000 people turn off the highway and go to Eldon, a little town in southeast Iowa, to pose in front of the house. The state Historical Society owns the property, but there's also a privately run visitor center right across the street, which opened about 10 years ago, and we work together with them to do programming that is relevant to the site. So sometimes there are art activities that you can make a painting inside the house, or there are pie festivals, or any way that you can give people an excuse to come back to a site that they may have been to before, maybe on a field trip in third grade. If you give them an excuse and a reason to come on a certain date and put it on their calendar, that is one way to keep attendance numbers up and make sure that new generations of visitors are coming to some of these sites.
Now, the stories of these sites, also the Blood Run National Historic Landmark, Montauk Historic Site, Plum Grove Historic Home in Iowa City, I mean, there are a number of sites that the Department of Cultural Affairs is responsible for, and we can't talk about all of them right now, but why do you think it's valuable for someone to visit one of these sites? Because the stories can be told in many different ways in many different places. Why visit the site?
Well, I think for so many people, you can read about history in a book or you can see photos, but there's another light bulb that goes off when you are there on site and you're surrounded by the place where some corner of history happened. So if you can connect your story and your life to the place where somebody famous lived, even briefly, there's a different kind of experiencing there's a different kind of experience that sinks in a different way there than if you're just flipping through photos on your computer or wherever else. So these stories that are connected to these historic sites, they sink in different ways. So I think it's important to maintain those as visual aids or props to the bigger scope and the bigger sweep of history.
Do you feel like technology has made it easier for people to find these sites? I know we've talked on this program about the Iowa Culture mobile app, which if you put this on your phone, you can see where all kinds of historic sites are all over the state of Iowa. Do you feel like technology has actually been a boost for some of these small sites?
I think it can be. A couple of years ago, the State Historical Society, or the Department of Cultural Affairs, launched the Iowa Culture app, and it's connected to Google Maps, and you can just download it on your phone. It's free, and it maps more than 3,500 historic sites and cultural landmarks across the state. So if you are just walking around the neighborhood, you can pull it up and learn things about some of the historic buildings or artistic murals that you may have passed a zillion times on the way to the grocery store, but you can learn more about the history and the culture that surrounds you. You can also turn on an app like that when you're on a road trip, when you're visiting relatives or a trip to Des Moines or wherever, and you can just learn about some of the sites that are on your way, and it makes it easy to take a little detour and learn more.
Well, Michael Moraine, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Moraine, Communications Manager for the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs. We've been talking about some of the smaller historic sites around the state. And, of course, we were talking about the future of the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower Museum in Boone, Iowa. Coming up in just a moment, a conversation with Cedar Falls artist Gary Kelly. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Gary Kelly is an illustrator, painter, and printmaker who lives in Cedar Falls. He's illustrated 30 picture books. He's done a great deal of commercial artwork, illustrations for magazines, and worked as an educator. He's illustrating a series of concerts for the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Symphony. We'll talk about the Halloween concert in a few minutes, but we're going to start today with a conversation about his new picture book. It's called Next Year, Hope in the Dust, written by Ruth Vandersee, and illustrations from the book are now on display at the Hearst Center for the Arts in Cedar Falls with an event coming up tomorrow, October 25th. Ruth Vandersee is going to stop by the Hearst Center for the Arts, and Gary Kelly is here with me now. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, that's my honor. Thank you.
Well, let's talk about this project, Next Year, Hope in the Dust. It's a picture book that focuses on the Dust Bowl years. And having illustrated so many picture books over time, when a project comes to you, do you have a lot of freedom to decide, is this something I want to do or not?
Usually I do. Early on, maybe not so much. But at this point in my career, If I want to really enjoy the project, I don't do these picture books because they pay the rent, that's for sure. I do them because I'm engaged with the story. And I'm very selective on the books that I do, and I think a lot of publishers know that. And my favorite publisher, Creative Editions, has been a great partner over the years, and they're my primary publisher these days. I've worked for a lot of other publishers, but Creative is by all means the most creative. They're the most fun to work with.
So what appealed to you about this project?
This is an interesting pitch from Creative, actually. It's one of their books. I didn't know Ruth Vandersee's writing, which I really like. Now that I know it. They didn't think I'd be interested in a story about the Midwest, because most of my books for them have been about some more exotic, I guess, topics and locales. They ran it by me anyway. And her words, actually, her words probably pulled me in more than anything. The way she wrote it, and the way her writing feels like the landscape, and it feels like this. It just fits the story so well.
What kind of research did you do before creating the illustrations for the book? What do you have to do to prepare yourself?
research is a key weed. Excuse me, a key word for me, Charity. I thrive on research. I love the research part of all of my projects usually. And so for this one, obviously growing up in the Midwest, my grandparents were farmers before I was on this earth in Nebraska. So I don't know if they had any history of the Dust Bowl at all, but we've all heard a lot about the Dust Bowl era, I think, at least people my generation. And so I knew the general story, but I definitely immersed myself in the visuals by first watching Ken Burns' really great documentary on the Dust Bowl. And, of course, also in my studio, I have a wall of books, probably 1,000 books in my studio. And I have a lot of books on photography as well as painters and different art forms. But I have a lot of books on photography, photographers from the Great Depression and others. So that's where a lot of the inspiration came from.
But you tried not to copy photographs when you did the illustrations. Was that kind of a challenge for you, having seen these searing, heart-wrenching images?
They're iconic photographs. Mm-hmm. And so the last thing I wanted to do was revisit them in my pictures. These are pastel renderings, ironically made with dust, rubbing dust on paper. I did not want the reader that has seen the generic or the iconic photographs from that era to look at my book and say, "Oh, I know where that came from. I've seen that photograph." Number one, there could be a copyright issue, but that's not it for me. I want to take the subject matter of the photograph and then imagine it in my own sense. You know, I want to adjust it a little bit. I want to find a different point of view. I want to put together elements from other resources that I have to maybe say something very similar, but say it in my way.
In the book, the narrator of the story, at least at the beginning, is 12 years old, a young boy living on a farm that has been devastated by the Dust Bowl, and life is very bleak and difficult for his family. There's a moment when, you know, your images, of course, are very sophisticated, beautiful, but bleak. And then I turn the page and it looks like it was illustrated by a 12-year-old boy. Why did you make that decision?
I'm glad you responded to that, Charity. That's part of that's one of the wonderful things about working with Creative Editions. Once I get the assignment, I'm basically in charge of the visuals. They don't have an oppressive art director or art department. They leave a lot of it up to the artists that they use. And as I read Ruth's text, the boy is talking about how it used to be and how he enjoyed life a few years earlier before the dust storms hit. And so to me, it just seemed like an interesting way to do that would be to compare maybe the way a young boy would imagine the text on the page that faces it, an 8-year-old or a 7-year-old. And so I tried to just go back and revisit that. Ironically, it's not easy. It's not easy to go back and, you know, I had to dig out some of my own kids' drawings from when they were young. I looked at a couple of books I have of children's work, of pure children's work, not children's illustrators' work, on my shelf, and and then tried to, I guess, look at some of my old drawings and bring them into this book. And then you turn the page, and the next page has basically very similar imagery, but in the way that I work today, you know.
You had to get in touch with 12-year-old Gary for little while.
That's a long time ago, Charity.
So with your projects, I mean, making a living as an artist, I mentioned some of the many, many things you've done. I can imagine that you're always juggling multiple projects. So when you get a picture book project, for example, how much time can you give that?
Well, that's a really good question. Most of my book projects are fairly extended. I mean, I will have months to do a book, and so I can weave that into my daily schedule. Very seldom have they been crash and burn projects. Right now, I just got the go-ahead, actually, a couple of days ago to start doing sketches for a book on the photographer Jacob Riis, who documented about the same period, or a little earlier maybe, of New York tenement life. And so that'll be an interesting, the research on that'll be a little more challenging because I didn't grow up on the Lower East Side of New York. But,
and Ken Burns didn't make a documentary about that one yet.
No. So really, books are usually long deadlines, and I'm able to juggle those without too much stress. I'm able to juggle those with my in-and-out projects. And the farther I get into my career, the more selective I am on what I want to do. And I actually pitch projects to clients now. In fact, I heard earlier in your segment, I heard, if it was Michael Moraine, I guess, talking about Abby Gardner and the Gardner Cabin. And right now that's one of my personal passions is a graphic novel I'm working on about the Spirit Lake Massacre.
And we'll definitely talk about that sometime in the future.
When it's done.
Right. I want to talk about another project that you've been working on. And this is a collaboration with the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony Orchestra. And this is a series of concerts, although you have one coming up on Sunday, on October 29th, a Halloween concert. How do you illustrate a symphony concert? What's the idea?
Well, for me, I don't illustrate digitally. I know that's... that's the trend now for sure. That's where visuals are headed, but not with me, they're not. So it's like doing a book, basically, Charity. It's sort of like absorbing the information, absorbing or creating a storyline, a narrative, and then digging into my research and figuring out what is the best or the most interesting, not always the best, but the most interesting, maybe the most provocative way to visualize this part of the music. And with the Halloween concert, it's Mahler Nachtmusik. That's an extra challenge because there is no pure narrative to that music. There is no storyline to that music. At least that's what the experts say about it, and I've listened to it over and over, and I think they're right.
So you get to imagine your own storyline.
Yeah. And that was really fun for this. It also was probably one of the most challenging ones I've done. I think this is the fourth or fifth one I've done with the symphony now. But to be able to match the music up with a narrative, it's image after image after image. I think I created almost 40 new pieces for this.
Wow.
And I have a wonderful collaborator, a young guy named Jacob Mead, that I can sit in front of the computers in the screening room with him, and he can make things happen that I have no idea how I would do that.
So when the orchestra is playing, how are your images shown?
They're on a 30-foot screen suspended over the orchestra on the stage at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center. So it's a pretty imposing, format. And when your images are shot digitally and then projected, 30 feet across, there's not a lot of room for making a mess.
Well, you certainly see them in a completely different way.
Yeah, it's scary. I hope everybody enjoys the concert, but the concert is very stressful for me to sit in the audience and watch because I keep waiting for a glitch. And so far, we've been pretty lucky.
And do you watch the people around you to see how they're responding?
No, I'm pretty riveted on the screen. Although the last concert last December with Duke Ellington's version of the Nutcracker, which was great fun to work on. We had our 3-year-old granddaughter there, and I sat next to her, and so I watched her.
Yeah. So with this kind of project, I mean, how does the music play into your creative process? Do you listen as you're drawing, as you're painting?
Yes and no. I listen to everything front to back, start to finish at the outset, definitely over and believe me, on Mahler's Nachtmusik, I knew it a little bit, but I know it by heart now after the last 6 weeks or 2 months I've been working on this. But you try to match up the visuals with the mood of the music, maybe the tempo a little bit, the atmosphere, and the research that you do, you know, about the storyline that we have created, which in this case will be loosely based on F.W. Murnau's 1922 version of Dracula Nosferatu.
Oh, okay. So, and the images, I mean, you're telling a story with the music and the images. You don't have the luxury of words in this case. So do you feel like it's a complete narrative, or is it suggestive of a story that maybe people are already familiar with?
Well, in this case, we most of the times we do have some words, and I put them on the screen in sort of the same format as a silent movie, and also I'm doing all the lettering for this concert, so that's a lot of hand lettering. But I want it to feel that way. I want it to feel organic because it's an organic story, and the visuals are that way. Yeah, the thing that kicked off this series of concerts was The Planets by Holst, which I pitched as an idea to the symphony to Jason Weinberger back in 2005 or 6, I think. And that has text that inspired me. Holst had actually written liner notes that most people have not seen that were just amazing. And I thought, someday we have to put these on the screen and create images to go with them because this is such wonderful music, and that's where it all started.
This project, did you have it completed long in advance, or is this something that you come up right to the deadline with?
Oh, well, when I leave the microphone today, Charity, I'm going out to Jacob Mead screening room, and we're going to play with images on the screen. So
right.
It's down to the wire, but we have rehearsals the rest of the week, and everything will be, I think, totally lined up by Sunday afternoon.
So the picture book project has come out. The work is on display at the Hearst Center for the mm-hmm. Arts. You've got the concert coming up on the 29th. It sounds like, as a successful artist, your life is constantly juggling different projects as they come to different stages of fruition. Is that an accurate read?
Yeah, I couldn't work any other way. I mean, I don't like extreme pressure, but I really like to have a job list that I can look at and be excited about. It's very important.
So what's on the horizon that you're most excited about?
Oh boy! Well, the graphic novel. I'm very excited about the Spirit Lake Massacre graphic novel.
Well, and again, we're looking forward to it. Gary Kelly, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Charity.
The picture book is Next Year, Hope in the Dust, written by Ruth Vanderzee and illustrated by Gary Kelly. Illustrations from the book are on display at the Hearst Center for the Arts in Cedar Falls, and the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony will be performing their Nachtmusik concert on Sunday, October 29th, accompanied by the images created by artist Gary Kelly. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.